Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tomorrow, the Senate Judiciary Committee will vote on whether to forward Judge Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court to the full Senate for confirmation. Barrett's nomination is expected to move forward, and the Senate is expected to begin confirmation proceedings the following day. Judge Barrett's expected confirmation is expected to play a decisive role in a number of key cases, including Affordable Care Act litigation, voting rights cases, and on the future of the availability of abortion. Last summer, I spoke with Diana Green Foster, a researcher on a landmark study that measured women's outcomes in health and well-being after seeking an abortion, including women who received the procedure, as well as those who were denied or were restricted. The result is the Turnaway study, which answers a number of key questions about this very private decision. The most key indicator is it refutes the argument that abortion actually harms the woman seeking it. In comparison, those who had the procedure versus those that carried the child to term, the former had much better health outcomes. Diana Green Foster is a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at the University of California at San Francisco. Her book, based on her research, is titled The Turnaway Study, 10 Years, 1,000 Women, and the Consequences of Having or Being Denied an Abortion. It's published by Scribner, and I spoke with her back in June of this year. Professor Foster, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Your study was nominally designed to answer the question, what happens when a woman seeking an abortion is turned away? But the Turnaway study actually answers far more questions that have often been asked in our public debates over abortion about that decision a woman makes to terminate a pregnancy or not. What were the key questions that you wanted the Turnaway study to answer?
So when we started this study, we were really looking at trying to answer the question whether having an abortion hurts women. And there's been a lot of question about that. And that idea that abortion hurts women has affected policy and people's attitudes and even the counseling that they get. But there wasn't very good data to say whether abortion does hurt women. And, you know, if a woman is in the position where she has an unwanted pregnancy, she can only choose between having an abortion and carrying the pregnancy to term and having a baby. And so if abortion hurts women, it has to be in comparison to the only other option. So the idea of this study was to follow both groups of women. All of them had a pregnancy that they wanted to end. Some of them got abortions and some of them didn't. So we ended up learning a lot about what it was to be denied an abortion, but our first goal was to look at, well, what's the experience of actually receiving an abortion?
Right. There's a telling passage in the book where a reporter asks a legislator in Ohio, why do you think a woman decides to terminate the pregnancy? And he thought about it, he hemmed and hawed, and he basically had never even thought about that idea.
Yeah, I think we deal with this topic so abstractly that we don't think about the women who are in this situation and what their options are. So that state representative actually came to the right answer eventually, which is that largely it's a financial decision of feeling that they can't afford to have a child or another child.
But a lot of the questions you answer, I was surprised at. It sounds like there's not a whole lot of data asking women about this decision-making process prior to this study.
Yeah, there really is a, considering that abortion is very common, there between 1 in 3 and 1 in 4 women in America will have an abortion over her lifetime. It's surprisingly understudied. And partly, I think, is that there isn't a lot of funding for this research. And also, it seems like a political topic and not a scientific topic. But since women are actually having this experience all the time, it deserves some scientific attention.
Tell us about how the study was designed, the questions you wanted to answer in the course of the study beyond the first question of what happens to a woman when they decide to have an abortion. And was this a nationwide study? It sounds like you went to abortion clinics from North Dakota, the one in North Dakota, to the Texas border and East Coast to West Coast.
Yeah, we ended up recruiting from 30 abortion facilities across the country. Those places that you named, Maine to Southern California and Washington State down to Florida. We had the whole country covered. And we we picked sites that had the latest gestational age, the latest limit in pregnancy where they would provide an abortion within 150 miles. So if someone showed up too late for that clinic, there was no facility nearby who would do an abortion later. And we recruited from each of these sites. For every one woman they turned away, two women who were just under the gestational limit and received the abortion. And then because most of these sites had limits in the second trimester, but the vast majority, 90-something percent of women who have abortions in America, do so in the first trimester, we also recruited a woman in the first trimester. So we were looking to say, what's the consequence of being denied an abortion compared to being just under the limit and receiving it? And how does having a later abortion compare to having an earlier abortion?
Tell us a little bit about who gets turned away, because from what I could read in the book, it seems pretty arbitrary depending on where you live and, you know, how far you have to travel, your ability to get to an abortion clinic in certain states where there's one in an entire state, such as North or South Dakota. And it seems pretty arbitrary.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The leading cause of presenting late for abortion is not realizing you are pregnant. And that can happen for a whole host of reasons. It happens disproportionately to young women who maybe never have regular periods. It can happen to women who've just given birth and so their body isn't on a normal cycle anyway. It can happen to people with chronic health conditions that have the same symptoms of pregnancy. And some people just have irregular periods, so it makes it a lot harder. And then once you're a little late in pregnancy, meaning anywhere past the first trimester, all of the logistical hurdles to getting an abortion become much greater. There are fewer providers that are willing to do it. It costs more. You have to travel more. And so then all the delays snowball until sometimes people are too late.
Let's talk about that idea of not knowing a person is pregnant. I'm a man, so I'm sort of disqualified from this debate in the first place, but I think you tackled in the back of the book where you talk about some of the myths surrounding abortions is that, you know, the idea that every woman gets morning sickness is a fallacy. The fact that you're missing periods doesn't necessarily mean you have discharges that might resemble a period. There's a lot of misconceptions around this idea that you know when you're pregnant.
Yeah. I mean, there's just such a huge range of experiences and body reactions to pregnancy. So we all know some lucky woman who, you know, was in labor and felt no pain until the last few moments, you know, because people's bodies react differently. And then there are people who are in a lot of, I'm talking about for delivery,
right?
You know, who are in a lot of pain the second they have their first contraction, because we just all react differently. And the same is true for early pregnancy, how sick we get, how tired we are. It's funny, I did a separate study that found people who were super tired and exhausted actually managed to get an abortion faster. And you'd think being tired would slow people down, but no, it's a crucial indication that they need to know that they're pregnant.
Well, going back to the study, this study took place over 10 years. And I was really struck by something, you know, it struck me when you wrote about it in the book, was that we're talking to women who get abortions, but we're also talking to the people who are turned away at these clinics. And First of all, that's an interesting question and dynamic to ask at the moment you're being turned away from a service. You finally said, okay, yes, I need to get this service, and you can't get it. And a researcher says, hey, can we come talk to you for the next few years?
Yeah.
What was that process like?
the people who worked at the abortion facilities were very skeptical that anyone would want to participate. And it was only the success of a few different providers, Tammy Kromenacker in Fargo, North Dakota, and people at the San Francisco General Hospital. They both, you know, I think, felt like the research was important, and so they should humbly ask women, given they're in a tight situation, would they be willing to share what's going on with them with researchers? And what we were asking them to do was to talk to us every 6 months for 5 years. And although they wouldn't have known it at the onset, very few of our questions had to do with the pregnancy and abortion, because what we were interested in was their mental health, their physical health, their economic well-being, the well-being of their children. And very little of it was specifically tied to that pregnancy that happened up to 5 years ago. But we had, you know, a huge range in responses. And the important thing is that there weren't differences in willingness to participate by whether the woman received or was denied the abortion.
My guest today is Diana Green Foster, a professor at the University of California, San Francisco in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences. She was one of the principal investigators in the Turnaway study. It was a 10-year study looking at women who received an abortion and those who didn't. So the name of the book is called The Turnaway Study, 10 Years, 1,000 Women, and the Consequences of Having or Being Denied an Abortion. It's published by Scribner's, and she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you said at the beginning that the central question that you wanted to ask was, what was the cost of a woman deciding to terminate a pregnancy as far as their mental and physical health? And what did you find? You know, you're absolutely right. Pro-life advocates often speak about the physical and mental health costs to women who have this procedure. Did you find that there was a cost? Did you find that to be the case?
We found that we looked for various things that people have posited are consequences of abortion. So increasing depression or increasing anxiety or not mental health, but just emotional responses like regret. And the general trend is absolutely towards improved mental health over time. So there was no increasing onset of anxiety and depression. In fact, those symptoms went down over the 5 years. But interestingly, they went down for both women who received and women who were denied abortion. So we wouldn't say that, you know, having an abortion improves your mental health. We would say that it has no effect on your mental health. But one exception is that women who were denied an abortion actually had elevated anxiety and lower self-esteem in the very short term after being denied. So that being denied was a very stressful experience, but over time, they look just like the women who received an abortion. And the biggest, you know, fact that comes from the Turnaway study, or the most quoted fact, is that over 95% of women don't regret their abortion, that they feel, looking back, that they made the right decision.
Right.
And I think that's surprising for a lot of people. And it also, you know, people do know folks who did regret. And yes, that happens. It's not that nobody experienced that, but it's an extremely rare event.
I think if I remember correctly, about 3 to 4 to 5% do regret having an abortion, but the same percentage of mothers who were turned away felt that they wished they had had the abortion 5 years out. Right.
Yeah, it's similar, and interesting to note that the people who are more likely to say that are the people who place their child for adoption. So I think that is a particularly difficult decision to make. And there are people who become pregnant and know immediately that they're going to place for adoption, and we don't have those people in the study. But the people whose first choice was abortion and then were forced to carry the pregnancy to term and their second choice was adoption, those people had a very hard time.
One of the questions you asked as this study continued was, you asked the women in your study why they were deciding to have an abortion. And as you might expect, there were a variety of reasons. And I think one of the things you've actually determined was that most of the time it wasn't just one decision. It was a number of factors.
Yeah. People will give, we didn't tell them, oh, pick from this list of acceptable answers. We just said, what are the reasons? And we wrote them all down, and then later we grouped them into similar types. So about 4 in 10 report that they're just financially don't have enough money to support raising a child or another child. About a third say it's not the right time for a baby. About another third say their relationship with the man involved in the pregnancy is not good enough, or even maybe violent, and therefore not a good environment for a child. And then the fourth most common reason at about 29% is needing to focus on their existing children. So about 60% nationally, outside of my study and within, about 60% of women seeking abortions are already mothers. And for about half of those, they want this abortion because they need to take care of the kids they already have.
I guess one of the follow-up questions is, why are women becoming pregnant if they don't want to have a baby? And this was where you actually looked at contraception, the usage of contraception, how it was used. And you found that a lot of these women who didn't want to have a child were using contraception of a sort.
Yeah. I think it was about two-thirds of the women in the study had been using contraception in the month they became pregnant. They, you know, women are at risk of pregnancy for about 30 years of their life, and if they want to have only two children, which is the average, that's a lot of years of trying to prevent pregnancy. And although contraceptives are very good, they're not perfect. And not only that, but people don't have perfect access to them. So a separate study I did found that one in five women seeking abortion, their reason is that they had run out of birth control and not gotten a resupply, that it was a trouble of access to contraception. So it's actually quite difficult to successfully, consistently use contraception from the time you first have sex through menopause with and only have the exact number of children that you plan to have. So I think we need a little bit less judgment on people who experience unintended pregnancies. And then there are people who have, you know, a bad reaction to the contraceptive options or have health conditions that are inconsistent with using.
One of the things your book does is you use 10 case studies through the course of the book to illustrate some of your points, very poignant stories from all of these women. Tell us a little bit about some of these case studies and why you wanted to include them into the book.
Yeah, I think that people's understanding of abortion is probably not going to be entirely fixed by my quoting statistics at them, and that it's hard to understand why anyone would do this or how the experience would be if you don't meet real people who have them. And because it's so stigmatized, people don't tend to talk about it. So we interviewed 30 women at the end of our study who had completed all the interviews, and we asked them, okay, you've answered all the questions. Now could you just tell us your story in your words? And I picked 10 of those 30 to profile in the book. And they just represent a huge range of experiences, from people who knew exactly what they wanted and they went and did it, to people who had a very hard time deciding, to people who took too long to seeking care and were denied. So I start with a woman in Texas who her reason for wanting an abortion is that she had a child already. And she'd actually become pregnant accidentally with the first child and had placed the child for adoption and had become really depressed upon doing that, and so went and got the child back and was in the midst of raising this child when she became pregnant again. And so she knew she couldn't place for adoption, and she knew that she didn't want to have another child, that she wanted to give her existing child everything in the world and not try and do it, start all over again.
I'm going to focus on a question that you alluded to just a moment ago, and that's the idea of the decision to seek an abortion rather than not. This is it's an entirely personal question, and I would think there's a lot of agonization over that decision. What you found was, for some it is, for others it's a straightforward decision. Tell us about that decision-making process.
So we asked people how difficult it was to decide to have an abortion. And for about half, they said that it was difficult or very difficult. And the other half either said it was straightforward or even easy. And I just want to caution against thinking that easy means thoughtless. I think it's just that they looked at all of their circumstances and decided that they're really they couldn't see a way forward of carrying the pregnancy to term. And so the only option was abortion. And then it was an easy decision, not necessarily that they hadn't thought it through.
Now, it seems like on some of the people who made who thought long and hard about this and couldn't make up their mind. It affected the outcome for some people, didn't it?
When we look at people's emotions about having had an abortion, the people who had a very difficult time deciding were more likely to report some negative emotions. So, you know, they knew it would be hard, and in fact, they did have a harder time. But the more common experience is it's not very common to have negative emotions, but one of the risk factors for having negative emotions is that you had a very hard time struggling with the decision.
Yeah. I was actually thinking about people who actually ended up being turned away because they waited too long. Was that the case?
Yeah, being turned away is rarely a problem of taking too long to decide. The decision-making tends to be pretty similar between the women who received and women who were denied an abortion. What's different is the time it takes to discover that they're pregnant, and then also all the time to find a clinic, raise the money, get to the clinic. Those two sets, the discovering you're pregnant and all the logistical hurdles, that's where the time difference is, much more than that the people who were turned away took longer to make the decision.
One of the things your study does is you follow the women who were turned away for 5 years. And is there some central conclusions you can make about how that decision made at the clinic affected their lives?
Yeah, we measured all sorts of outcomes for people, economic outcomes, relationships, health. And what we find is that women who were turned away had much more serious health complications from the pregnancy than women who had abortions, which is not surprising because they were pregnant for longer and delivery is more of a complicated event than having an abortion, which I think is surprising to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So large physical health differences, including two women who actually died after childbirth, which is a sign of an extremely high maternal mortality rate, much higher than we would have expected. And then other differences have to do with relationships. So there were no differences in whether the woman stayed with the man involved in the pregnancy by whether she got an abortion or not. But 5 years later, the women who got the abortion were more likely to be in what they rated as a high-quality relationship. So there were, and the biggest differences had to do with economic outcomes. So the people who were denied abortions, they wanted an abortion because they felt they couldn't afford to have a child, and we see that they are more likely to live in poverty if they have the child than if they don't. And that's not surprising for most people. Obviously, having a kid is expensive. But some women who got the abortion had a child later, and those children actually were less likely to live in poverty than the child born because the woman was denied an abortion.
Hmm.
So being able to wait a little bit actually improved the kid's economic outcomes.
What about adoption for those women who were turned away? One of your myths at the end of the book is, you know, adoption is the solution. How many of them considered adoption, and does that enter into your analysis at all?
Yeah, we continued to follow women whether they placed the child for adoption or decided to parent the child. And we were very surprised that that more women didn't place the child for adoption. And people give, you know, all sorts of reasons about why they didn't. More women said that they were considering adoption than actually placed the child for adoption. I think there was a feeling that they didn't want to not know what was happening with the child out in the world without them, or they didn't want, the child later to come back and feel angry that they hadn't been parented. And so, but people had a range of reasons. And I think that, that the assumption that adoption is an easy solution is not a good assumption. It's involves a physical health, risk, carrying the pregnancy to term and delivery that is, a very big deal. And also, it's just not naturally what most people would choose. So only less than 1 in 10 women who are denied an abortion actually place the child for adoption.
I want to go back to something you said just a moment ago and just alluded to again, was the idea that, you know, there's this belief that abortion is physically risky versus going through the process of childbirth. And I guess all evidence tells us that's not the case.
Yeah, I think both pro-choice and pro-life sides have emphasized the danger of abortion, and for different obvious political reasons. But the truth is that abortion is safer than, you know, tonsillectomy and wisdom tooth removal in terms of complications. And it's much less associated with much lower complications than delivery. And that, if you think about it, isn't too hard to believe, because the woman's body goes through huge physiological changes for pregnancy. And so having her be pregnant for, you know, a third to half the time is going to be associated with lower risks. But the complication rate for abortion is actually very low. We had no major complications from abortion, but we had several serious complications from childbirth.
And in fact, two women in your study died during childbirth, correct?
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. One woman on each coast ended up dying from complications related to delivery. And I believe both times the child survived, but one of them, she also left orphaned other children. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty heartbreaking.
One of the things you do is you also write about the ability to access abortion services today. You write, there are far more restrictions to abortion today than in 1973 when Roe versus Wade was first affirmed abortion as a constitutional right. That may seem counterproductive, but I guess in states where it was illegal, it was just simply illegal, and there were far less restrictions in 73. How's that affecting a woman's ability to receive abortion services in many parts of the country today? You go through a number of the procedures you have to do to be able to get an abortion in a lot of states.
Yeah, we estimate that about 4,000 women don't get their wanted abortion every year because they show up too late in pregnancy and there's no clinic that they can get to that would go later. But there are many more women who would want an abortion are unable to get it for other reasons besides gestational age, so that they are within, you know, even the first trimester but can't raise the money or get to a clinic or have the social support they need to get there. And the truth is nobody knows exactly what the number of women who would want an abortion and can't get one. But the number of restrictions now on abortion is pretty staggering. I think over 900 in the state-level restrictions in the past two decades. So there's some of those restrictions, I suspect, have very little effect. But some of them that increase the cost of abortion or increase the distance people have to travel, those probably actually do result in people carrying unwanted pregnancies to term.
The name of the book is The Turnaway Study. Diana Green Foster, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Diana Green Foster is a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at the University of California, San Francisco, and was lead researcher on the Turnaway Study. Her new book is titled The Turnaway Study, 10 Years, 1,000 Women, and the Consequences of Having or Being Denied an Abortion. It's published by Scribner. I spoke with her back in June of this year. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.